Fellow writers, it's KJ at the start of another hashtag AmWriting episode. This week, we're talking with an author who's had amazing success across multiple genres, which is not an easy road. The most important thing she has to tell us is this: take the time you need to figure out what book you want to write. If you're in that process, though, you know it's hard, whether you're working on writing fiction or nonfiction. Sometimes it helps to work through some clarifying exercises, and that's where our sponsor, Author Accelerator, comes in. Head to authoraccelerator.com to find prompts to guide you through the process of narrowing what you're writing and where you're going, and more. And a second note, normally, hashtag AmWriting is a non-swearing zone, but our guest this week got a little salty, and because that's who she is, we are leaving it in. It's minor, and it's all in good fun, but we thought a warning was in order.
The Am Writing Podcast is usually a no swearing zone, but this week we got a little excited. So if you have young ones in the car with you, you might just want to, you know, think about those sensitive ears. There are a few instances of swear words in today's episode.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag AmWriting. Hashtag AmWriting is the podcast about writing all the things. Nonfiction, short fiction, long fiction, short nonfiction. Yeah, okay, you can tell we are length neutral here. This is the podcast about writing the proposal, writing the pitch, writing the actual thing, because we are the podcast about sitting down and getting your writing work done.
And I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed, and various things at the New York Times and at the Atlantic and at the Washington Post. And I'm working on my next book, The Addiction Inoculation, on basically keeping our kids drug and alcohol free until they can walk off into their wonderful adult lives. And then we can just say, okay, we're done parenting them now. Which leads me
to
KJ, you do your intro.
Well, yeah, except you didn't let me introduce.
No, you got to introduce
myself.
Yourself first.
Having just promised us all a book on, you know, getting this parenting thing right, so I can't wait for that. I am KJ Dell'Antonia. I am the author of, and most excited about at the moment, the novel The Chicken Sisters, which is coming out in June of 2020. I'm working on my second novel, and I'm also the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, which is exactly what it says it is and will not, in fact, help you raise your healthy, perfect... Yeah, yeah, it's just for you.
But The Chicken Sisters may actually help you make better chicken, so I'm sort of excited about that.
There are no recipes in this.
Oh,
sorry.
That's
I mean,
too
I suppose
bad.
You could pick up a tip here or there, but yeah, it will make you hungry, but it will not help you fix your problem.
Well, today we have a guest, and we have a very, very special guest, because this is a guest that listeners of the AmWriting, hashtag AmWriting podcast have been hearing about for an awfully long time, because every time I talk about writers I admire, writers that have helped me be a better communicator, a better writer, and a better friend, honestly. And whenever we talk about competition and sort of dealing with the fact that there are other books there out there on the market that are competitors for our titles, this is the person I bring up every single time. Julie Lithcott, in such a good way, though. Julie Lithcott-Hames is with us today. And I have to, by way of introducing Julie, I have to explain how I know Julie. So I was a bunch of years ago, while I was writing Gift of Failure, I got an email from a former student of mine, Megan Andrews. I taught Megan when she was 15 years old in high school, and Megan went on to Stanford University, where she encountered Julie Lithcott-Hames. And Julie was the freshman advisor, this first year advisor at Stanford, and for many years. And Megan said, I have this woman, you are going to love her. She is fantastic. And I think you're writing books about the exact same thing.
Of course, the same thing was happening to me. Megan was telling me about you. Keep going. Yes.
Well, and it's, you know, for someone who's writing a first book, that is a sheer panic moment. I think, I don't know if I emailed my agent about your book or about someone else's book, but I'm like, oh my God, panic. What's going to happen? Someone's writing a book on the exact same thing. No one's ever going to read my book. And I think going into that was, there was this moment at which we finally got to know each other and realized that there is an incredible power in lifting up other writers and in sharing the stage a little bit. And the reason that I bring that up with you is that you have written this incredible book, How to Raise an Adult. You've written another incredible book, a total pivot book called Real American, and it's a memoir that's just spectacular, and I want to talk about that a little bit. But when I think of Julie Lithcott-Hames, I think of a person whose goal isn't really about just parenting. It's about helping people, helping lift up other people. And that's, I wanted to have you on the show to talk a little bit about author collaboration, about approaching the way you interact with other authors and even competitors. And that's why I bring you up a lot, is that I feel like through my relationship with you, I had this opportunity to view this person who I was in direct competition with. And as we came to find out, and we'll talk about even before the books were sold, that we have turned that from a competition relationship into a collaborative relationship that I am so grateful for and incredibly proud of. And so without much further ado, Julie, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, Jess, thank you for sharing all of that. And hi, KJ, as well.
Hello.
I feel, I can hear the fluttering heart that was in you when those realities were upon us. And like you, I couldn't believe somebody else was writing such a similar book. Plus, I had the added sort of survivor guilt is the wrong word, but basically your book was supposed to come out first.
Right.
But you'd had an equestrian accident.
Yeah, I bonked my head.
You had a concussion.
Yeah.
And so your book was supposed to be out first, but because you'd had a concussion, things had slowed down. So my book ended up coming out first, and it mm-hmm. shouldn't have. Yours was slated to come out first. Mine was going to be like this, you were supposed to be the first princess and I was supposed to be the second princess. I'm thinking about this kid's book that I used to read my kids, and mine came out first, and it didn't feel right or fair to me.
You've never told me that before.
Yeah, no, it really, I was like, whoa. And because we have Megan in common, I knew, how amazing you were and how incredibly heartfelt your connection to kids is and was. And I just really felt for you around the accident without even knowing you. I just was like, wow, that sucks, man. That's not, poor, this woman, I mean, geez, concussion. Okay. So then the New York Times asked me to write your New York Times book review. Remember that?
And of course, I had no idea until right before it came out.
Yeah. And so I think that in some ways was the beginning of collaboration, not competition, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I loved your book and I said so. I said it was an amazing book. And it showed me, and I hope you, that, hey, there's room in this space for both of us.
Yeah.
And of course, it was my first New York Times thing, which was exciting for me. So your book became an opportunity for me to show up in the New York Times book review as a reviewer, which was incredible. And so I was grateful to you, sort of secondhand for that. You didn't ask me to do it. Obviously they asked, but it was your book. And then you said yes to a joint event back east in Connecticut at the Gunnery.
Oh, right.
Right? We did a joint event mm-hmm. and that's when early on. And that's when we saw okay, this is going to work because everything was additive. Everything was, we weren't literally treading the same path. You have this perspective. I have this complementary perspective. I have this perspective. You have this kind of complementary perspective. So I think we offer, kind of our own unique approach to a topic we both care about. And it's just been delightful. I think we've done 3 or 4 joint things, maybe just 3, but every time it's like, oh yeah, Jess. And then of course I go around the country and I'm always talking about you. I'm always talking about The Gift of Failure. And KJ, I love your Happier Parent book as well. And I talk about it, particularly when, you know, we're focusing on, wait a minute, why is this so hard for us parents? Why are we so fucking miserable? you know, I cite the honesty of your book, like, yeah, we are miserable. And, you know, here's someone who's going to tell it like it is and tell you how to deal. And so anyway, it's been a pleasure. I live 3,000 miles away from y'all. I'm out here in California. As your listeners know, you're very much back east, ensconced in the snowy winter. But I feel connected. And that is super important to me because ultimately, as you said, you know, my meta is about connecting with humans and that matters to me. And you said something nice, helping, you know, lift up others. I mean, I hope occasionally I'm able to do that, but mostly it's just human connection is my juice. It's like,
yeah,
you know, just getting to, you know, people are my jam. So, I'm grateful to you both. And thanks for letting me be on the podcast.
Well, you did something really amazing with your, it was such a pivot. After you did How to Raise an Adult, you did Real American. And Real American, I want to talk to you a little bit about that book because you took some real amazing, huge risks with that book, not just in the content, but the way the book was written. And before I do want to talk a little bit about those risks that you took. But one of the things that you did that I had never seen anyone do before that was so interesting was during your book tour for Real American, and I had the privilege of seeing you speak in Austin at Book People. And before you went on, and I didn't even know this was something you were doing, you had gone ahead to each of the locations where you were going to speak and solicited a young writer, usually a high school student, I assume, to read before you read, to give young people the opportunity to have their voices heard out there in the world as well, to give them a little bit of your stage. So this is something that, like, not only are you doing this with the other, you know, authors out there, but you're doing this with kids as well. And that was a real sort of moment where I said, oh, this is a real money where your mouth is sort of situation. And that's why I mentioned that thing about helping raise others up, is because the girl that I saw speak that day, by the way, she was a poet. She kicked, man. She was amazing. And it was really cool to see a young person given this incredible opportunity. And I sat in front of her parents and they were like in awe of Julie, like, we can't believe some published author is giving our child the ability to put her voice out there in the world. How did you come up with that idea?
You know, I'm feeling moved as I listen to you describe it. Because it was so touching. Every single place I went, it was so touching for me to hear young people whose sense of self and ability to construct language around their truth was so much more mature and self-aware than I had ever been at their age. And I think, so Jess, I appreciate your mentioning it. So I had Real American's about my journey to learn to love my Black and biracial self in a country where Black lives were never meant to matter. And so it's this journey into this pit of self-loathing and up and out of that pit into self-love. And my younger self was so frail and fragile on the inside I now know at 52 and knew at 50 when the book came out that it's so important for me to be one grown up in the life of a young person who sees them and who honors them and who celebrates who they are. And so it was more often than not a young Black poet or spoken word artist. Everywhere I went, that's what we were looking for. If there were no Black people in the town or in the school, which was occasionally the case, I said, let's broaden this. Anyone who has been made to feel like the other, who has written something about that, you know, I'd love for them to open for me, is how I put it. And once they were as young as 12, I think the oldest was maybe 25. I want to give a shout out to one of my former students, J. Marie Hill, who worked with me, who's an artist and an educator and an activist, particularly in the trans community, and they live in St. Louis. But J. Marie and I were talking about this. I said, look, I want to give an opportunity for young people to take the stage. And, an open for me. I just think that would be, I think I thought of it as an act of service. You know, I was going to do a good deed. And J. Marie said, okay, so what are they going to get in return? And I kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, you know, well, they're going to open for a published author and, you know, I'll give them a signed book. And J. Marie looked at me and just paused and said, why don't we pay young artists?
Yeah.
Why do we refuse to pay young artists? And they just looked at me and I was like, oh shit, I get it. And so my practice became the signed book and a $50 honorarium, which isn't a ton of money, but for a child, it's not nothing, to say the least. And then what I said is I thanked them. And if they were comfortable with it, you know, hugged them and put my arm around them. I said to the audience, look, I'm doing this because I have all the privilege of a book tour and a stage and marketing and a microphone, and you're here as the audience. And before I take all of this privilege and use it, I want to step to the side and make room for other people younger than me coming up on the path behind me. And so that was the purpose. And I, as I said, I think I thought I was doing a good deed. And to some small degree I was, but of course the far greater thing that was happening, the dividend, the unexpected dividend, was they enriched the entire event with their language and their presence, right? I learned, I grew, the audience was enriched. And so they served me. It was an act of service to me that they showed up and offered their art in connection with whatever I was trying to offer. And so it became a very humbling moment for me time after time and an opportunity for more growth on my part. So it was one of the best choices I've made in quite some time. And I'm really glad you were there in Austin. I wish I could remember the young woman's name, and maybe I can pull it up before the end of the show and I can give her a shout
pictures.
Out.
I still have pictures, and I recorded part of it. Yeah, it was so good.
Yeah.
It's so funny you say that, because when I first, I listen to music before I go on stage just to sort of get myself in the zone.
Pump you up, yes.
And the first I used to listen to when I first went on book tour, and this was like all about me, I would listen to My Shot from Hamilton. Like, this is it. Like, I got to get up there and really bring it. And then I changed the song that I listen to every single time before I go up on stage to You Will Be Found from Dear Evan Hansen. Because the focus of why I'm on that stage has really shifted over time from being about, oh my gosh, this is my big break, to why am I doing this in the first place? Like, why am I taking all this time away from my family and spending all this time on stage? And it's because there are a lot of kids out there that are feeling not seen, not heard, not given the opportunity to be found. And it's been interesting for me how that this whole journey has changed its focus for me. And so anyway, seeing you have a kid up there and paying them for their time, we, you know, the very end of our podcast, we talk about the fact that we paid everyone for their services on this, including the person who wrote the intro music, because, you know, creative people are supposed to be, should be paid for their work. So it's
absolutely,
it was a great statement that you made by doing that. And I loved it. And it really did add to the evening. Can we talk a little bit about, you did something that would have scared the pants off of me with Real American. You had written a book, How to Raise an Adult, that was very, you know, it beautifully written, but nothing unexpected in the narrative in terms of, like, you know, it looked like a normal nonfiction book that you'd pick up in the bookstore. And then you pick up Real American. Real American is in a font that was unexpected. It was some places it was more poetry than prose. It was prose poetry. It was in a voice that was really different. Did you feel really free to do that? And how did that work with your editor?
Well, only a writer would ask this question. And I'm so glad, because it is absolutely, of course, as you and KJ know, absolutely intentional, absolutely something I had to fight for. And I'm delighted to tell you why. So I left Stanford as a 44-year-old. I completed 10 years as dean of freshmen. I go off and enroll in an MFA in writing program in San Francisco at California College of the Arts to try to write How to Raise an Adult, to develop confidence and craft. Got my book deal while I was there, but I didn't want my parenting book, quote unquote, to be my master's thesis, because it didn't feel brave or edgy. So I kind of wrote that book on the side in my MFA. when it came time to graduate, I was 4 years into a 2-year program because I'm now touring How to Raise an Adult. My faculty says, like, you've got to graduate. You need to do a thesis. And they forced me to write the next thing, which became Real American. And so I was really clear as I set out to write that thing that here I am, this Black woman in the era of Black Lives Matter, raising a Black son, learning to love myself finally in my 40s after, you know, a young adulthood and adolescence of self-loathing because of all the small acts of microaggression and blunt force racism that I had experienced. And now I'm in this place of, you know, I don't give a shit what people think about me. I love myself and y'all can do what you want. And so I was trying to figure out how do I depict that on the page? And so when I sat down with my Mac AirBook and opened Word for the first time to start to write that thing, I looked at the screen at those preset margins. And the first thing I did was yank the right margin in 1 inch because I said to myself, for some reason, I couldn't articulate it this way then, but I knew I wanted to constrain my voice. And so I just did that. And the book often, you know, I go to readings. I just did one last night and people are like, oh, you have a nice wide margin. That gives us a place to write notes. And I'm like, yeah, great that you write notes. I love that. But that's not why I did it. I did it because as a Black woman in the United States of America, I don't have access to the full page. But I'm going to try to make damn good use of the space I've been given. And so the constrained voice was choice one. And then it became about font and letting and voice, of course. And when I submitted the manuscript and we, you know, obviously everyone knows the whole process. You work back and forth with your editor on the content, on the language, on what's missing, on what's extraneous, on what's shitty, on what's, you know, all of that. And then at some point they send you the interior design. And that's the first time I knew that they were not paying attention to my font, my letting, or my margins. And so they sent me this thing with a serif font. So the font is sans serif. And, you know, letting is the space between lines. And of course, the margin I've already described. And they had ruined all of it. And I just gasped. It was like they had shorn, you know, I had taken my child into the barber and they'd cut all its hair off. And
had you explained to your editor ahead of time what you were trying to achieve?
No, I didn't think I needed to because I thought it was so obvious from the Word document. You know, the Word document looked exactly the way I wanted it to. It hardly looks accidental. You know, many of the chapters, this is a book with a zillion chapters. Every, you know, there's 9 parts to the book, but then all the little, you know, the subdivisions within each part are labeled with a Roman numeral. Some of them, some chapters are only 3 sentences. Some are a paragraph. Some deliberately end at the bottom of the page. And what happened was I got the document back. And because they had changed the letting, changed the font, and changed the margins, my deliberate, you know, conclusion at the end of the paper page was now kicked 5 sentences over onto the next page. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this serif font was a flourish. I said, look, this voice is not a flourish. I'm not kicking up my heels and dancing. This is a voice that is stark. This is blunt. This is this is unadorned. I want the voice to be bare and naked on the page. And they said, people can't read a sans serif font. I said, they're going to have to figure it out. And finally, I said, if this was a book of poetry, you would not be arguing with me like this. So let's pretend that that's what this is. Because as you've said, there are places where I do relax the rules of syntax to let the language perform on the page the way I want it to. They knew that much. And I said, let's just pretend it's more poetry than prose. You've got to go with me on this. And I fought and I fought and I fought. And to their credit, I mean, as a newbie writer, I don't know how much latitude and leeway I even have when I make arguments like this. You know, in the beginning, as I'm sure the two of you experienced with book one, it's like, I'm so glad I have a contract. I'll do anything, right? And now I had a little bit more agency with my second book. I was like, fuck no. You know, I wrote this for a reason and you are not going to undo. It was like they were, you know, I knitted a sweater and they were unraveling pieces of it. It just felt like an assault. So I fought for it and I'm grateful to the people at Holt, who are my publishers, because they were like, okay, fine, we get this, we get it. We're going to do this. And they did. So it was quite a fight.
It reminded me a little bit of, I don't know if you ever read Darren Strauss's Half a Life, but it's a memoir about he had hit a girl on a bicycle and killed her when she was, I think she was about 17. He was about the same age. And so the book is very much about unfinished or, you know, incomplete things. And there are blank sections, blank pages. There's chapters that are just a few lines. And it was very easy to understand based on how the book was published. But if it had been published in the regular, with a regular sort of spacing and regular chapters, it wouldn't have been half as impactful to me. It was sort of a view into what writing could be as opposed to, you know, what I've always experienced it as. It was a big moment for me. I was really appreciative, knowing, of course, that for that publisher, it was probably way more expensive for them to leave blank space. It's exactly. A big deal. It's a very big deal.
Yeah. So I don't want to derail anything.
No, go ahead.
But I am wondering how much your publisher wished for you to continue in the vein of the very successful How to Raise a Grown-Up when you said, "Why, no, here, welcome to The Real American."
Well, KJ, this is an opportunity for me to give a shout out to my agent, Kim Witherspoon. It was in this moment you've just foreshadowed that I learned how tremendously valuable an agent can be. Here's what happened. I completed the manuscript for Real American. As I said, it was my MFA thesis. So I completed it in May of 2016. And I was vocal, as I am. I'm a big sharer on social media. So I had been out on social media talking about what I was writing. And my editor gently said, "I see you're working on some new material. Would love to see it." So I was like, great, that's exciting. I gave it to my agent, Kim. And she and I talked about it a bit. And she was like, "Okay, I'm going to take this to Holt because Holt has the right of first refusal on my stuff. And, you know, I'd be happy to publish with Holt again." So off she goes. And then I'm on a plane like 3 weeks later and I get this phone call from Kim. She's like, "Okay, here's where we are with your memoir. They're happy to publish your memoir and they want a sequel to How to Raise an Adult." And I was like, "Oh God, ugh, I don't want to write a sequel. I'm not a parenting, you know, I don't want to do that. I just want, you know," and she was like, wait, let me tell you how we got here. Okay. She said, "I went to them with your memoir and they were like, yeah, we'll publish that. But first we want a sequel to How to Raise an Adult." And that's when my badass agent stepped in and said, "The memoir is what's ready. And if there is to be a sequel, it'll come second." And so she was then presenting that to me. And I was like, okay, wow, that is, thank you. And okay, so I was getting that the opportunity to write the memoir was, or to publish the memoir, was in part available to me because I was also going to do the sequel. And I was really grateful then for the role my agent had played and grateful, frankly, to the publisher that, you know, they were going to publish this little memoir on race in addition to the thing they wanted. Now, of course, that what then happened was Donald Trump became a viable candidate as we were working on Real American. And all of a sudden, my little memoir on race became much more relevant to our moment. And I think they were accordingly more invested in it than they might otherwise have been. I'm not trying to malign them at all. I'm just saying, you know, the book just be like, they sent me on a book tour for it, which was amazing. They didn't send me on a book tour for How to Raise an Adult. I cobbled that shit together by myself with friends. I mean, thanks to Facebook, you know, my publisher did not send me one foot for How to Raise an Adult, but they sent me around the country with Real American, which was awesome. So I think, KJ, they have come around to understanding who I am and what I'm about. And I really feel that this is a relationship now, not just with my editor, but with the head of sales and marketing and with the publicist and with, you know, the Speakers Bureau. I mean, I'm Holt all the time at this point. And I think they get me and I think they dig me kind of. And, you know, that feels good. So, and now I finally am excited to write this sequel. In the beginning, I was like, "Oh, I got to write a sequel. You know, I don't want to write this book. I don't know how to write this book." And finally I have found the voice for it. It's going to be out 3 years later than it's supposed to be, but you know, I'm about 60% done with it. And I'm actually developing that feeling, you know, that feeling we get when we know we are writing something that is of quality, that is firing on all cylinders, when we're in the zone and we're like, "Yeah, this is amazing." Right. And it's not every day and it's not every page. But I'm starting to have those feelings about this book. Thank God. That's how that happened.
It would have been hard to write that.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that's familiar to both me and Jess, and we have talked about it here before, is that sometimes I mean, and it can be a lucky position to be in, but sometimes we find ourselves pressured to write a book that we don't want to write. And it's something to be wary of.
Especially if you're going to have to go out and speak about it a lot,
yeah.
Because then you're talking about having to live with something for years and years, and man, hopping on a train because it's a popular train to be on, for the wrong reasons can be disastrous. So I'm so happy for you that this is coming together in a voice that you love.
How many potential sequel versions did you run through?
Can we go there? Let me tell you first. I loved the being on a train you don't want to be on. So in the beginning, when we were, well, I signed a contract for Real American, which was basically the book you've seen, half of the book you've seen. I amplified it in volume. In length, but the content was, they knew the content they were buying. How to Raise an Adult sequel was all the contract said. A sequel to How to Raise an Adult. Before we signed the contract, we didn't talk about what that even meant. Okay, so then I'm on the phone with my editor 4 months later, and she's like, hey, I know you're working on Real American, just want to check in with you about the sequel as well, I think we should have some kind of framing conversation. I said, yeah, awesome. So she goes, yeah, so this will be a book for parents of grown children who are struggling with adulting. And I said, Barbara, the author of How to Raise an Adult is not going to write a book for the parents of grown children. I reject that terminology, grown children. Like, no, they're just grown. Like, yes, they're still your children, right? And she sort of chuckled. And I said, look, they're going to read this, I have no doubt, because that's what a generation of overparenting has done. They're going to be all up in this. But the narrative voice is going to be directed to the young adult. If I'm going to have any credibility with them, I have to be writing to and for and with them, not about them. And so that was our first argument. Then, because there was not even a book proposal on the table, I got my advance over 4 installments, signed the contract. The second installment was submit an outline that's accepted. And I had 3 outlines rejected. They were like, no, 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 this is not right. You know, they were like, where's the chapter on money? I'm like, who am I to write the chapter on money? Like, I'm not that person. I am not that person. You know, where's the chapter on health insurance? I was like, oh God, you know, those books exist. I can't do that. And, finally, I just kept playing. At one point I was arguing for a chapter on relationships, and they were like, you know, this was actually, somebody younger in the organization who's an editorial assistant who was on the phone with me and my editor and said, you know, we've been told in our 20s we don't have to work on relationships, that we can focus on that in our 30s. So I don't think this chapter needs to be in there. And I was like, yeah, and I disagree. I think that's terrible advice. And I'm going to say so in this book. Like, you know, relationships.
What does she think she's having with the people around her?
Well, anyway,
acquaintanceships?
I don't know. So, you know,
meetups?
argue. And I was determined, KJ, to your earlier point, or maybe it was Jess, one of you said, sometimes we find ourselves pressured to write a book we don't want to write. And I was determined that I was going to write the book I wanted to write. Look, I'd been a former, I am a former college dean. I have talked with young people and enjoyed their company and their conversation and enjoyed, you know, caring about their fears and their dreams for a long time. And I knew if I could summon that voice on the page, that I could get to where I wanted to get around the subjects the publisher wants me to cover. And so finally I was able to get there. And, and I've said to myself, who knows, right? I hope I will never be in a situation where I am in fact pressured and do write a book that I don't want to write, because that violates everything I believe in about how important it is for all of us to be doing stuff to sort of live with integrity and authenticity. Like, how am I going to write a book on how to live your life if I hate writing the book? If I don't believe in the book that I'm writing, how are you going to believe a a word that I say in there, because I'm basically saying, well, they made me do this, so I'm doing this, right?
Well,
so,
and then you have to get up in front of people as a speaker.
No, I couldn't.
And
I couldn't.
As a speaker, you got to look people in the eye and explain why they need to believe a word you say and what you mean, right?
Yeah. So this book is like, I call it a compassionate beckoning. It's it's for millennials and older Gen Z. It's, you know, it's for folks who are struggling with what they have termed hashtag adulting. And it's me, this older Gen X person, like, yep, I know it's terrifying, but come on in, join us. It's your turn. And it is terrifying. And it's also unbelievably amazing. So let's go.
And I can't wait to read it.
It's a very close voice. And it's like we're having coffee. It's like I'm sitting there chit-chatting with you. I'm listening to you. You know, it's not a, you know, I'm the authority, I have the answers. It opens with this, I'm just going to tell you, I have to show you how this opens because I'm so excited, actually. Sorry. And if it sucks, you're going to be like, that sucks. Do not publish that.
yeah, I'm just right
gonna,
here. We'll
I just,
do that.
I'm just going to read you like 4 lines. Okay. I am not wiser than you. I have been broken, sad, scared, bewildered, worried, and ashamed. I try to help humans make their way in life. I'm rooting for all of us to be okay. This book comes from that place.
That's excellent.
That's a good start.
That's great. I love it. Especially
It's within the introduction. It's about 3 paragraphs into the introduction. That's just what I paused to say. And that's kind of the vulnerability that I'm trying to bring to the page, which is just delighting me. So
I mean, that vulnerability is what reaches people. I think, you know, the only reason that any of us can, you know, who are trying to put out that expert voice, which, by the way, super scary yeah, having to put out some expert voice, is by admitting that, you know, we're no better. We just have read some other stuff and we've read some evidence and we're trying to help guide and that we respect
and
the
we've
people
lived.
Who are reading it. Right.
And we've
right.
lived. This isn't a book, you know, How to Raise an Adult might have had 400 footnotes. This book is going to have 0 footnotes. I refer to research, but I'm not citing it because I don't think this is a book that wants to be about research. It wants to be, you know, what does this person, this author have? It's my impressions based on the life I've lived. It's stories. There's a lot of narrative in it and storytelling, and it's you know, there's a little bit of advice. Hopefully the advice springs out of the stories as opposed to like research shows you really need to do X, Y, and Z. It's like, dude, I've lived this life and I'm a little bit older than you and I have fucked up and I have failed. And this is what I've learned. And this is what I want for you and what I want you to know.
It's almost like you found a way to marry How to Raise a Grown Up and Real American. I mean, that's not probably a novel insight. You completely have. You're going to take those two. You're just expanding the audience, you know, sort of bringing everybody together in, hey, if you like somebody's voice, you don't only have to like it in one space.
Right. That's right.
And
that's exactly
right. I
want to
bring this whole picture together of Julie with the fact that I happen to know that Julie, you know, got to a place in her career where she realized that her big, huge dream was this writer thing. Like she had some serious goals around writing. And she wrote this book that went on to be a New York Times bestseller. She got to write a New York Times book review, which I happen to know was also one of your goals, to write something there. And now it's my understanding that you get to write the introduction to an entire book on writing memoir. Is that correct?
Wow. Yes. You know, it's
think about that circle there, Miss Lithcott Haynes.
You know, I appreciate that, Jess.
it's pretty cool.
You know what? It's very cool. And it's very like, what? Are you sure you want me to do this? But it's also a tiny little book. It's a writing prompt series for writers. And so, you know, it feels sort of like, you know, here we are in our writerly community and it's an offering to people who are, farther behind me on the path of writing. So that feels like, okay, I can kind of feel a little bit more authority there as opposed to like, I'm making these grand pronouncements about memoir to all the people who've written memoir. It's not a conference of, you know, celebrated memoirists. It's me trying to offer something, to folks who would like to do what I did in pulling Real American together. So it's this awesome little series called Lit Starts, published by Abrams. And we have 6 of them. 4 of them are on craft. writing memoir, writing humor. I mean, sorry, writing humor, writing character, writing action, writing
dialogue. Dialogue. I have that one in my hand right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. And then two on genre, writing sci-fi fantasy and writing memoir. And so there are these adorable little writing prompts that are kind of juicy and fun. The booklet is just full of them. And it each one of these opens with an essay by a published author. So I got to be the essayist who wrote the opening bit for Lit Starts Writing Memoir. And it was so much fun to dig into, you know, which, you know, let me find six or seven memoirs that I want to write about here as examples of stuff that went well or stuff they did right. It was an opportunity for me to honor other memoirists from Roxane Gay to Frederick Douglass. You know, to just try to be a little bit more analytical about a process that had been very personal. So I really enjoyed it.
You want to hear my favorite line about, I have a little tiny book by Abigail Thomas on memoir, and my favorite advice she gives is, so remember, the writer of memoir makes a pact with her reader that what she writes is the truth as best as she can tell it, but the original pact, the real deal, is with herself. Be honest, dig deep, or don't bother. I love that one.
Absolutely love that. But let me tell you this, I say this in the book, I say, look, truth is subjective. All right. As long as you know, the three of us are sitting here on a conversation and we're all going to have a memory of it. And if we were all to write a page after we hang up about what happened, and, you know, as long as we are obligated to write what we think happened, that's all truth. And we would write three completely different write-ups of this conversation because we remember things differently. Some things stick in your brain that aren't going to stick at all in mine, or I'm going to hear it differently, or I'm feeling differently as it happens. So therefore I experience it differently. One of the prompts in Lit Starts Writing Memoir is write a Thanksgiving scene from your perspective and then from the perspective of somebody who was in the kitchen and from the perspective mm-hmm. of the guy that showed up late. You know, it just honors the fact that we all have our own truth. And as memoirists, you know, we have to constantly ask ourselves, where does my story end and yours begin? We're not mm-hmm. supposed to be telling other people's stories. We can't deploy the trick of fiction where you can get into the head of somebody else's character. We are the character, we are the narrator, and we are the author. We inhabit all those roles and we are obligated to the truth. But it's also equally valid that that truth is subjective. And I think that's a really important thing for memoirists to appreciate and feel okay about. The line I like most in my essay is, I don't have it in front of me, but it's something like, memoir should not be an act of navel gazing. You know, if you just want to like tell people about your amazing life, like write it down in your journal and let that be for you. A memoir should be an act of service. You know, you think like, I have gone through an experience that might be of benefit to my fellow humans. That's why I write memoir. And your citing of Darren Strauss, Half a Life, I mean, anguish for Darren, right, of what happened. But what an offering to anyone who has inadvertently committed a tragic act that harmed another human being. I mean, that has got to be one of the most devastating life experiences. And as cathartic as it probably was for him to dig into that, and that was valid in and of itself, what a tremendous gift and offering to people hungry, desperate to know, I am not the only human who has had this abjectly horrible experience. What an act of service that was.
Well, and to write it as an act of therapy would have ruined the book also. Right. So writing memoir as an act of therapy.
I can't tell you how many we have jointly set aside and said,
yeah,
this needed to gel for another 30 years.
Yeah, this person should have gone to therapy before sitting down to write this book. Or written the book for themselves.
Before we go on, I just want to shout you out for saying my favorite line in my essay was, because that's awesome. I have favorite lines and things that I have written. I know
I
Jess
it.
Has favorite lines and things that she has written. Serena has favorite lines. We have each other's favorite lines. But, you know, hello, everybody. We are allowed to have your favorite line. Put your favorite line into, you know, download one of those little quote creators and pop your favorite line in there and add a little dash and then add your name. Because that's you.
Yes.
And
right.
Put that out there.
On Instagram.
That's what we do, right? Yep. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Own it, yeah. own it, claim it, celebrate it. Absolutely. We can be a little self-deprecating as artists and writers and looking for other people to celebrate, hopefully cross our fingers that other people will recognize what we've done and like it and maybe celebrate it. But absolutely, we have to own the work that we've put out there. And boy, those favorite lines, you know, I have a favorite line from my memoir that somebody just tweeted. And I was so thrilled. It was a stranger who heard me say it out loud and tweeted it. It's a description of my father where I say, he had these crude nicknames for me when I was little, knucklehead, old sport, even worse things than knucklehead. And, and I said, the line is like, it sounds crude to my grown ears, but spoken in the butter of his baritone, it felt like melted love. Spoken in the butter of his baritone. Nice. It felt like melted love.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, this dude heard me say this to an audience of a couple hundred people, and he pulled it out. And he pulled it out, cool. And he wrote it down, and he tweeted it. And, you know, that, I was like, that was a gift to me.
Yeah.
That he had heard me and was leaning in so intently, you know, that he was there for it in the moment, and he remembered it, and he wrote it down. I mean, that was gold.
That's pretty cool. That's why I always take pictures of people who have copies of my books with all the note cards and notes. The underlines and the, yes. Oh my gosh, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
speaking of other people's work, we have to wrap it up, but we always like to talk about what we have been reading and loving these days. And I know you're deep into the work of writing your book, so I'm assuming a lot of the work you've been reading lately is about that, but is there anything you'd like to shout out?
Yeah, absolutely. Two things. One is a book on friendship. It's called Literally Friendship by Lydia Denworth.
We love it. We just interviewed her.
Yes, oh, I'm so glad. That's well, I got to read, I got to write a blurb for it. So I read
Yeah, you did. I saw you there on the back.
Yep. And what I loved was, because I'm writing this book on how to be an adult, you know, and I'm talking about relationships, as you know, I insisted, like, I will talk about human connection with humans in this book, and to have this incredibly well-researched, and it's this narrative about other people's research, right? To have this justification that human connection is what makes us live well and long, it landed like a gift in my mm-hmm. mailbox. I was like, thank God, there's proof for what I intuitively know, and many of us intuitively know is true. So that book I loved. And then a companion to it in many ways, Wildhood by Barbara Natterson Horowitz. This is an examination. It's Wildhood as sort of a description for that period that we call adolescence. It's after childhood and before maturity in the animal kingdom. They trace four different young animals, a penguin, a wolf, a whale, and I think a meerkat. And they tracked them and traced their journey once they left their nest or their home or, you know, wherever family was. And what they're demonstrating is meerkats and whales and penguins and wolves and humans must go on these journeys away. The writer in me of How to Raise an Adult was just like pumped up fists, like, yes, yes, yes. This is evidence from evolutionary biology that what we do when we overparent our kids and hold on to them too hard and for too long harms them. That they
well, let
have
me close,
this.
Let me close yes. this loop for you. The co-author is Catherine Bowers.
Yes.
Catherine Bowers is a friend of mine. And
no
I
way.
Saw that you had Instagrammed a picture of the books you were taking away on your writing retreat. And one of them
yes.
was her book. And I called it to Catherine's attention. And
yes.
she actually emailed me and asked me to reintroduce you because you and Catherine Bowers went to college together.
Holy shit.
You were
That's
in the same
amazing.
Class. So you will be getting an email from me.
I love it. What
to
a
you
small
and
world.
Catherine, because she yeah. wanted to get back in touch after she heard that you were reading her book.
Well, I saw that on Instagram. She, you know, commented under the photo, like, I'm so glad that my book is in your stack. And I was like, wow, I loved this book. So that's such a small world. So yeah, those are two people out there in the world doing the work to prove
right.
the hunches that I have about humans. I'm someone who cares about humans. I love humans. I'm trying to help remove the obstacles from the path of humans. I'm not a scientist. And so I'm always looking for the evidence that what I intuit, what I understand in my bones, I'm looking for the evidence that it's true. And that's probably the lawyer in me, the former lawyer in me, that's like, you can't just have feelings, Julie. You got to back it up. So all of these people who do the work of really excavating the underpinnings for what I would say is the magic of the human experience. I'm just, you know, really excited about their work. So yeah, Wildhood and Friendship. Absolutely. Yeah. Thumbs up. Yep.
Two great, great choices. I'm reading a book that KJ actually recommended to me. This is testament to, even though I thought I owned every single book that's out there on the planet about substance abuse. I mean, it's like shelves and shelves and shelves. All of a sudden, KJ texts me a picture of a book and she says, oh, I assume you have this, but blah, 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 blah. And I didn't even know it had come out. So it is a book called, it's called Quit Like a Woman, The Radical Choice Not to Drink in a, to Not Drink in a Culture Obsessed with Alcohol by Holly Whitaker. And I'm really, really enjoying it. It's not just about drinking and why people drink, but it's specifically about female women and the culture around drinking and how drinking is marketed to us and how we portray ourselves as either sober people or not sober people. And it's, and how we use alcohol to cope and how it's marketed to us in a way that sort of makes it attractive to use alcohol to cope. And it's a really good read. Holly Whitaker, well done. I'm really, really enjoying it. KJ, what have you been reading?
I want to go back and shout out a book that I talked about a couple of episodes ago, because, and when I talked about it a few episodes ago, I was a little like, I don't know how I'm feeling about this book. It's called How Could She? And the author is Lauren Mecking, or it's something along those lines. Obviously, it'll be in the show notes. And it's this, it's a novel about three women's friendship from three protagonists' points of view. And I said at the time that, you know, the problem with it was that I often just wanted to slug the protagonists. Like, they all had these great lives, but didn't appreciate them. But I kept reading for some reason. Like, every night I would literally say to my partner, maybe tonight will be the night I like this book. But I kept reading it. And, you know, eventually there was the night when I liked it. And not only did I like it, but I liked the whole thing retrospectively. Because what I realized was that the author had pulled off this sort of really amazing feat of showing us FOMO and the envy that we have of other people's lives and the way that it masks the good things about our own lives. And I thought, sort of, you know, given the nature of what we talked about here, that that was a great thing to kind of come back to and talk about. And it was annoying the whole time because you wanted to shake the people and say, but your life looks good. I mean, sure, this other person, but, you know, you've got it good. And anyway, it was, it's a cool book. So How Could She? Recommend. Not, it's not like an easy laugh a minute kind of read, but it's not a hard read either. It's just, as you read it, you're kind of going, why am I like why is this so mesmerizing? And I think the answer is because we're experiencing that so often without even realizing we're doing it to ourselves.
I always, the books that you stick with, even though you are like, why do I still care? Even though I, you know, Olive Kittredge was one of those for me. Why am I sticking with this, even though I hate her?
Yes.
Those are fascinating to me too. There's some connection that's being made, even though you don't necessarily like them. So
yeah. I also want to draw everyone's attention to another podcast that I have been loving.
Good.
Called the Creative Pep Talk Podcast. And the podcaster is Andy J. Pizza. I can only assume that's probably, but whatever. He's Andy J. Pizza. And once you hear him, you're like, yes, you are Andy J. Pizza. That is fine. And I really wanted to call out this episode called 20 Surprising and Super Powerful Prompts That Will Make 2020 the Year You Do Your Best Work Ever. And you have to understand that he's like always tongue in cheek about this crazy. He's like a super enthusiastic person. But the interesting thing is that the prompts were so different than what we think of as creativity prompts. These were more like prompts like, remember how apparently Will Smith went and looked at the top 10 best grossing movies of all time and figured out what three things they have in common and went after those. Look at the top things in your industry and figure out what three things they have in common. Or, you know, go and look at something that's in the public domain and figure out what you, you know, and imagine a different version of that. Or imagine you have synesthesia. What does Tuesday smell like? So they weren't, like, they weren't so much writing prompts as they were thinking prompts, and it's fun, and he's always fun to listen to.
And
although I would definitely
prompts.
Put him in that you either you'll love him or you'll hate him. I love him.
I love it.
All right. Well, this has been tremendous, Julie, as always. The thing that's really sad for me is that it's hard for me to get to your speaking events and hard for you to get to mine because we're usually waving at each other as we fly across the country.
Yes.
But it is just always a pleasure to talk to you and to have a chance to get inside your head, because I so respect the way you frame your work and the way you enjoy your work and the way you live your work. That's really inspirational to me.
I appreciate that. I'm grateful to you both. You have an amazing podcast. You have an amazing rapport with each other. And so there's such energy between the two of you and as individuals too. So I'm really grateful that you had me on. Is it okay if I share my website if people want to follow up with me?
Oh, please. That was going to be my next question. Where can we find you?
Cool. Yeah. So Julie Lithcott Hames, if you can spell my name, put it into Google. JulieLithcottHames.com is my website. All my social media contact info is on there. I have a newsletter you can sign up for. And my speaking schedule, just, you know, you're mentioning how we are like ships that pass in the night on our speaking tours. Jessica reminded me, if folks want to see where I am next, I have about three months at a time up there on the website. So check it out. Follow me. Connect with me. I'd love to hear about your interest in the topics I write about. So I tend to engage with people pretty well on social. So I'd love to hear from listeners if they want to share anything.
And we will link to all of those in the show notes. We will have all of this in there.
And
so thank you, everyone. Oh, yes.
Yeah, Lit Starts Writing Memoir, that little book that I wrote, is coming out any moment now. So anyone who's trying to write a memoir, check it out.
All right. With that, everyone, until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag Am Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work. Save. Pause. Stop. Thank you.